So this episode of the Truly Horrible NBA podcast is a special edition in which I conduct an interview with Joseph Gill. Joseph is an NBA independent analytics consultant. He does analytics work directly with NBA players as well as people in the collegiate ranks hoping to break into the NBA. But on top of that, Joe is one of my personal very good friends and also, you know, the summer league correspondent for the Truly Horrible NBA podcast. So I hope you enjoy the podcast, and here it is.
Hello, and welcome to the Truly Horrible NBA podcast. Joining me, not as always, is our summer league correspondent, Joseph Gill. Joseph, how are you?
Hey, what's going on, guys? I wish I could do a Dale Porter intro, but that's not my skill set, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's okay. And Daniel, unfortunately, isn't going to be joining us. So I don't even know what I'm going to do on the next pod because I can't even say joining me as always is Daniel. We'll have to figure it out.
Oh, no, that's right. Yeah, never speaking absolutes.
Ugh, I know. I really messed up. I set myself up for failure here. So Joe is our summer league correspondent.
I'm sorry, man.
No worries. Joe is our summer league correspondent. Joe, how are the accommodations that we set you up with?
Let's not talk about that. Let's talk about fun stuff.
All right. So Joe was in summer league for most of summer league. He just left today. So he's missing kind of like the last couple days, but you know, he was there for the vast majority of it. And we just thought we'd have Joe on to kind of talk about, you know, some of the guys for our teams who played in summer league and kind of get his feedback for someone who was actually like there to watch them play. You know, I was able to catch some games on TV, but it's just not quite the same as being around, hearing what everyone's talking about and everything. So, Joe, I was figuring we'd start off with the Suns just because you seem to have the most to say about the Suns. How does that sound to you?
Sounds pretty good. I mean, I think the Suns are probably the most interesting team at Summer League as far as, like, you know, they had, what was it, two lottery guys playing, and then they had Josh Jackson playing as well. So they actually had Dragon Bender. So they had four lottery guys playing in Summer League, and there's a lot to talk about with them.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, four top 10 picks even, you know, not even just lottery guys.
Yeah, oh my goodness. And let me tell you, watching the games, it did not feel like that. Like, you know, normally if you get four top 10 picks playing in the summer league, you'd expect that team to be walking to the championship. And I'm not even sure if they won their elimination game playoff play.
No, they got upset by the Sixers. The Suns were the 3 seed, and the Sixers were the 30th seed, and the Suns
right,
got upset.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that. I saw the end of that game, actually.
It was devastating for the podcast. It's really the only time we get to watch the playoffs, and our team was losing.
Yeah, Robert Sarver was sitting courtside. I think he just, you know, punted a basketball. And, no, he wasn't, of course.
All right. So you want to give us your thoughts on DeAndre Ayton's play?
Yeah, I mean, that's a logical first guy to talk about, I think. And I mean, as somebody who I've watched a lot of Arizona this year because of my career and the requirements that come with it. Nothing that DeAndre Ayton did this week surprised me, which is a bad thing because – coming into the draft, I mean, like, obviously, everybody knows why Ayton went number one. It's been talked about to death. You know, he's a freak. He's 7'1". He's built like a Greek god. You know, and as far as his weaknesses, you know, like, everyone knows defensively he struggles a lot. But the thing I don't think is talked about enough is that, like, offensively, he's kind of lost. He doesn't really know how to set screens. He kind of just, like, stands around and just waits for his teammates to find him or the ball to find him after an offensive rebound. He looked just downright pedestrian a lot of the time when the games were competitive, and it kind of would come in the last 3 or 4 minutes in mop-up time, put down a few dunks, have some decent stats, but I mean, I walked away feeling very affirmed with my DeAndre Ayton take, which is not a good thing for the Suns or DeAndre.
Yeah, one of the things I really noticed in watching him play, talked about on the last pod with Daniel, is just, it's really concerning how much he's willing to settle for bad mid-range jumpers. Did you notice that as well?
That is nothing new.
Yeah, I was hoping when he got to the NBA that stuff would be ironed out, and look, it's still early, it's just summer league, but, I mean, if he's just going to shoot mid-range jumpers like that, he's never going to be an efficient offensive player, and with the defensive concerns, that's alarming.
Yeah, I mean, he was a guy, like, you know, in the process, he said the right stuff, and so I think people were very happy to explain away a lot of the issues in Arizona this season, and, you know, like, I think this summer league also proved that, like, between Raleigh, Alonzo Trier, and DeAndre, no one on that team was really put in a position to be the best version of themselves. But at the same time, I mean, like, some of that weight falls on DeAndre as well. I mean, like, you know, when you've got that type of body playing college basketball, you know, you should be making life easier for your guards, not harder. And, you know, I don't buy this whole narrative that it was the guards, you know, were the first and foremost issue on that team. DeAndre could have done a lot of things to help them between, like, setting better screens, popping, rolling harder. You know, sometimes he wouldn't even pop or roll at all. Like, you know, he wouldn't even open up his body to receive a pass on the pop. He would just stand there and kind of watch guys, you know, try and take people one-on-one. And, you know, obviously there's some frustration in that, you know, because, like, you know, if you think you're getting the ball, you're going to pop or roll every single time. But whenever I see somebody doing that, that is an immediate red flag because, you know, that shows that, like, best case scenario, he's letting his emotions dictate action that is hurting his team. Worst case scenario is there's a lot about, you know, stuff that I won't touch on, but fill in the blanks.
Right. So I guess one of the things I want to touch on, you touched on his screening there. How much of his screening issues do you think are just he's new to basketball, he's only been playing for, you know, a few years now, he just doesn't know how to set them? And how much of it is these, like, concerns about effort, would you say?
You know, I would almost say that there's a third concern as well, and that's just that he doesn't care. And I don't know how much it is in every single camp, but right now I think that the most nuanced, most educated take we could possibly have with the information available to us now is that it's some combination of the three. And, you know, I'm generally somebody who, like, I think that the rope for being new to basketball, especially for big men, kind of ends around the 3 to 4 year mark as it comes to the fundamentals of the game. Like, I'm not expecting the guy to be able to, you know, like, jab, break down the first level of the defense and make a good read at the second level of the defense. That'd be ridiculous after 3 or 4 years. But, I mean, like, you know, between his coaching and prep school and then with Sean Miller, he should know how to set a screen. I'm sorry. It's just, like, you should know that. And he just, for some reason, does not, or if he does, he just doesn't feel like he has to do it the correct way. I would be very concerned about this. I mean, it's an easy fix, but, you know, if it's such an easy fix, it's kind of a catch-22, because why hasn't it been fixed by now?
Right. I mean, like, if you really think that screening is something like, oh, it's just he needs to learn how to screen, like, that should have been fixed the second he walked onto Arizona's campus, you know? Or the second
yes.
he got on the Sun Summer League team. But,
Well, I mean, not to toot my own horn, but, you know, like, to give some context to listeners, I played a little bit of college basketball. I was a post. I was 6'8". They teach you how to set screens in high school. And, you know, not everybody gets the best coaching in high school, but everybody should know how to set a screen by the time you're getting to college. Once you get to college, if you're not setting good screens on the first week of practice, they're going to teach you, this is how you square up your shoulders. This is how you make contact. And, you know, it was actually kind of crazy. One of the common trends in summer league this season, this year, was big men not setting good screens. And then out of the guys who are not setting good screens, Aiden was near the bottom, I thought.
Interesting. Do you think that some of the issues that big guys this year in summer league were having with setting screens is just the fact that, you know, with AAU basketball really emphasizing perimeter play and everything, a lot of these big guys are trying to hone their perimeter skills but aren't learning, like, the core components of taking advantage of their size, such as setting really effective screens?
You know, I'm a big proponent of AAU basketball.
I am too. I am too. I think it makes
yeah.
a better game, but I'm just wondering
but
if that's...
No, obviously, you know, like, there are guys like Mitchell Robinson is a prime example of a guy, you know, there was a video of him pre-draft doing one dribble rip throughs from half court, you know, like, yeah, that's an NBA play. I'm really happy to see a 7-footer spotting up at 42 feet and taking guys off one dribble. But, you know, like, obviously, like, coaches have to be more lenient with the most, you know, outlier talents, and they have to, you know, if the guy wants to float a little bit, they're going to have to let him float. But at the same time, you know, AAU basketball is a lot of pick and roll. I think the culprit is more the fact that, you know, these kids, they don't need to have to set good screens to get open in high school or even college, some of them. You know, just by being bigger, stronger, and more athletic than everybody else, they're going to get open whether or not they make contact with the ball handler's man or not. And so, you know, now it's kind of, you know, a culture shock. We're like, oh, this is how I've always been doing it. What has changed? You know, and some guys figure it out, some guys don't. But yeah, I think it's just an issue of, you know, like, in basketball, if you're that much of an outlier, you know, when it comes to the things I just mentioned, you're going to get open regardless of how sloppy your fundamentals are.
Yeah, that makes sense. One more thing I want to touch on with Aiden before we move on to the other guys is how did his defense look? Was there any improvement?
Oh, terrible. Absolutely terrible.
Man.
Sorry, I completely cut you off there, but I mean, like, there's just no other way to cut that one. He doesn't move his feet well. He doesn't understand team concepts and defense. I thought he was ball watching a lot. You know, as far as, like, when people initiate contact with him, they'll clear them out. He'll try to muscle them. But he's not a very proactive defender. He's very content to just, You know the phrase, take what the defense will give you? Ayton's very content to take what the offense will give you, which is the wrong way to defend.
Yeah, that's, you want to be impeding the offense.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, you have to be, you know, somewhat reactive most of the time on defense, but the moments you're allowed to be proactive, you have to take those moments and make the most out of them, because, like, you're going to give up 120, 125 points a game if you don't do that.
Yeah. Was there any positives from DeAndre Ayton's summer league performance that you saw? Areas where maybe he seems to have improved since Arizona?
I mean, he seems like a nice guy.
Oh.
He got paid.
Yeah, that's not what you want to hear about the number one pick, that he's a nice guy.
Yeah, well, it's one of those things where, like, you know, we know what he does well, and how important is that in today's NBA? You know, like, he was one of those guys where, you know, you just fall in love with the body, you fall in love with the idea of him, and, you know, in practice, you know, this he could be a 2 to 3 year project when it comes to playing winning basketball on one end of the floor and never get there on the defensive end. And, you know, he could come out and he could put up, I think he's probably going to put up numbers, because how could you not with his, you know, stature and how much they're going to play him and how much that team's going to have to look for him inside, considering, you know, just the dearth of scoring options on the perimeter. But this was not a very, you know, if I had to rate the top guys in summer league, even in just a lottery, I'm not sure if he's in the top 7.
Yikes. That is not what you want to hear from the number 1 pick.
No, it is not. I'm a big numbers guy, and those numbers do not sound good.
Yeah. Should we move on to the other lottery pick the Suns had this year, Mikal Bridges?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as much as, you know, I wanted to go in there and be blown away by Mikal Bridges, his first game was fantastic, and then you almost forgot he was on the floor at times, which I guess is kind of the point of him when you think about it. You know, like, he's not exactly a guy in that system with those players around him that you want him to be pounding the ball, and you want him to be like, oh, yeah, Bridges is really taking a lot of shots right now. You kind of want him to be that passive, you know, positive influence on offensive spacing, defensive structure, and concepts. But he was fine. You know, I didn't think there was anything about him that screamed steal. I think he's probably going to be a better player in the NBA than he is in summer league, if that makes sense, because what he does is maximized by the defender's IQ, in the sense, like, you know, a smart defender would have to react to what he's doing, and, you know, he would cause that gravity. And in summer league, some of these guys are just, you know, hopelessly lost on defense, and the nuance of, you know, spacing and team concepts on offense is just completely going over some of these guys' heads. So it felt like his impact was largely minimal, but that's not exactly a cause for concern yet.
What did you think about his defense? How was his lateral quickness? That's kind of my big concern with him.
You know, it's one of those things in summer league, like, generally speaking, like, you know, it's hard to stand out on defense because the game is so sloppy.
Right.
And these teams, you know, like the sets of running are so basic. There's no cohesion because guys haven't been able to practice together. And there's, of course, you know, the underlying incentive to be selfish. I didn't notice anything about him on defense. You know, it wasn't like he was Javon Carter out there smothering people. It wasn't like he was, you know, just letting people walk past him. He's a turnstile. He was fine, I guess, is the way that I saw it. You know, at no point was I aware of his defensive positive or negative impact.
Got it. So overall, though, would you say, I mean, not a player to walk away concerned as by a Suns fan, but also not walking away feeling like you got a steal? He's probably just going to be the role player that he was sort of projected to be.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because Kevin Knox went 8, right?
Ninth, one pick before him.
Ninth, there we go. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's one of those things where, like, you know, when the guy who's at your position kind of shows out of summer league, you know, who's picked either one before or one after you, it's kind of always going to cloud the idea of, you know, that guy's performance. I wouldn't be concerned with him. You know, he showed enough flashes, you know, where it's like, oh, yeah, this is what he's going to be able to do for this team for 7, 8, 9 years, where, you know, I don't think there's any cause for concern. Like, I don't think anybody in Phoenix is going to be, like, you know, writing home about what a steal they got for him. But, I mean, that was kind of the MO in him to start with, you know? Like, he's fine. He's solid.
Interesting. You want to touch on Josh Jackson next?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where it's interesting because we go from Mikal Bridges to Josh Jackson. You just kind of get the sense already that it's going to be one or the other long term, you know? Like, it's if Mikal is good enough to start, what's Josh Jackson's role in this team? You know, like, where does he fit in with everybody else? Because, you know, I guess you could probably play Mikal at the four, but you'd probably need a much better defender at the five than DeAndre Ayton to get away with that. Obviously, Josh Jackson would help with the defensive deficiencies of the Suns team, but it just kind of feels like they're a bit of an island of misfit toys right now. You know, like, if all these guys pan out, what next? You know, I get the feeling that Josh Jackson's a prime candidate to be potentially traded the next year and a half, 2 years, because not by any fault of his own, but just because what's the plan there?
Well, what if he plays the two? What if Booker moves to the one and Jackson's at the two and Bridges at the three and they bring in another four, kind of a stretch four guy?
Is a time machine to take you back to 2003 playing the five? Otherwise, I'm out on that.
All right, that's fair. I mean, so you don't think Jackson can play the two?
I like the idea of it. I mean, it's interesting because all these Suns players seem to have, like, you know, at least one, if not two, fatal flaws, and Josh Jackson's is, of course, his shooting. As much fun as it would be to watch him just power through as in the perimeter two men, I'm not sure that would work, even with Booker playing the one and providing that much gravity. It'd be an interesting. I wouldn't mind seeing in lineup combinations, especially in games where, you know, they're trying to, you know, maybe they're trying to out tank like a, I don't know, like a Memphis or something. You know, like I wouldn't mind seeing it in games like that just to see, you know, if it's potentially something to look to going forward. But, you know, as far as the consensual fit in my head, I don't see it right now.
Interesting. That's disappointing because conceptually, I was really hoping that Josh Jackson would show better shooting, show a better handle, and the idea would be that he could, like, after summer league, you might be like, maybe he can play the two. And it's disappointing to me that you, having seen a fair amount of their games, don't feel that same way.
You know, it's interesting because, like, I want to like Josh Jackson as well. He seems like a really good kid. But, like, watching him play, just based on, like, the way he moves, based on, like, his skill set, you kind of get the idea that he's a better dribbling, more muscular Corey Brewer, which is, you know, once again, you better learn how to shoot if you're going to want to stick in the league as a high-end.
Yeah. And then, should we talk about the guy you found most concerning from the Suns this summer league and Dragon Bender?
I mean, I'm not sure if concerning is even the right word. Like, I this is like a panic sell at this point. I mean, I'm like, this guy, between his play on the floor, which was horrendous for the first two or three games. I mean, like, so much so that a buddy of mine who I was watching the games with before the Magic game, we actually bet on whether Jonathan Isaac or Mo Bamba would have more dunks combined than Bender had points. And yikes, you know, that's not something you ever want to be on the lesser end of in that bet. But, you know, he kind of came around a little bit towards the second half of the week, but you just look at the guy playing and you're like, you don't get it. You know, like, at one point it was one of those things where, like, I think it was in the fourth or fifth game, he caught a pass of the curl and he was wide open from one of the only times I saw him wide open in summer league. Instead of, you know, like, going up like a professional, going up like, you know, a guy who wanted to be there and dunking the ball, he did this kind of weird cradle, like, two-step right-hand lane without really jumping. And I remember turning to the guy next to me, like, does this guy not realize he's trying to show that he deserves his fourth-year option to be picked up right now? It just seems like the mental disconnect between his play and how he views himself, there's no other explanation. I mean, like, if you're 7'1" and you're that open, dunk the ball. I don't care if I don't care what your role is, where you're from in the world, how high you can jump. If you're 7'1" and you're that open, dunk the ball every single time. Because when you don't dunk the ball, you know, like, I hate to take one play and blow it out of proportion, but, like, it was definitely concerning. It was the effort level with him was just so nonchalant the entire weekend. He acted like he was too cool for summer league. And quite frankly, Dragon, you're not. You know, you should be taking these game reps and saying thank you because you need them still. He's a guy where if his fourth year option is picked up, I will be shocked at this point.
Really? You'll be shocked.
He was terrible. There's no other way to cut it. He was terrible on the floor. His attitude sucked. Maybe just got paid. You know, if you can trade him for a second round pick today, you have to have that conversation.
Wow. Like, so,
I mean, it's harsh. And, like, you know, if he turns, like, and it's one of those things where, you know, like, I run in a few different circles as far as, like, I'm an analytics guy by trade, but I was also a player, so I'm a little bit, you know, I'm too weird for the cool kids, but too cool for the weird kids, if that makes sense. You know, all the analytics guys there, you know, they're bending over backwards to talk about the potential and, you know, like the idea of him and, you know, like how he could potentially still make it work, which I, you know, it's easy to see the vision, you know, like whenever someone's 7'1" and can shoot 3-pointers, it's easy to see how he could fit, you know, and then you go talk to the former players, you go talk to the guys who, you know, are agents or who are managers and like, oh, this guy sucks, you know, like that, and that's the end of the conversation. There's no nuance in their take. It's just, this guy is terrible. Get him out of summer league, get him out of the NBA.
Yikes. So, overall, a fairly discouraging summer league for the Suns?
I mean, I don't understand how they were the 3 seed. I just really... They must have played a really interesting cream puff schedule to get the 3 seed because, you know, for how much talent they were supposed to have on this team, I walked away, you know, content at best and just absolutely horrified at worst with their top... with their former top 10 picks.
Man, that is not... That's not encouraging. I'm very disappointed to hear that. That was your takeaway from seeing all their games.
I mean, were you guys talking about graduating them potentially by December or January? Or
yeah, we did discuss that. Well, we thought, you know, we are hopeful. That's the hope, that they'll be good enough to graduate. Yeah. But
yeah, I can still see it happening. But you know, if I was a bookmaker on that, the odds would definitely be going down. You know, with every passing game, they look like they're headed for another top 5, top 6 pick.
Wow. In many ways, that makes the Mikal Bridges trade even more concerning. Because that was a trade you do when you think you're kind of ready to make the leap.
Oh, I'm a Bridges fan. You know, I'll do my best Dalen Porter impression, because him and I both agree that, you know, as far as how we viewed that trade. But, you know, in the whole time, you know, like, and Jared Jackson had some rough games, but, you know, the whole time watching Jared Jackson play versus DeAndre Ayton, you're just like, the entire time I was watching, I just felt so affirmed, in my opinion, that Jared Jackson Jr. was the best big man in the draft. Because, you know, even on his off nights, you could see the impact he was making. And on DeAndre Ayton's best nights, it was kind of like, well, let's see you do it when it matters. You know, it's nice that you're dunking the ball 3 times in the final 4 minutes, but what are you going to do for me to win me games?
Right. Well... Should we move on to one of our next teams? How about the Magic?
Yeah, unless we want to make this a 3-hour podcast. Sorry, the deep dives, I can't stop.
No, that's great. And I think the Suns have the most to talk about out of any team. So,
hey, man, I mean, you guys sent me out here. The least I can do is give you the much information as you paid for. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly. We put you up in really nice accommodations and everything, you know.
It's interesting. Cause like out of most of the media members that I talked to in summer league, like, you know, I didn't speak with Woj, but waved at him. I talked with Shams briefly. Like a lot of the guys that are like coming up now, they want to be the next Woj. It's interesting because, like, you know, they're sick of like trying to write like opinion pieces where they just get shit on in their mentions and in the comment section. And, like, when you think about it, Woj kind of has a nice job. He just reports the news. It's open ended, and people take it and run with it and provide the analysis. And they're the ones who are sticking their necks out, you know.
Yeah, I would not want Woj's job. It doesn't appeal to me. It's too much, you know, I just think it's a grind. It's, you know, it's an underrated grind, continually cultivating sources and all of that. Like, it is hard work what he does. I really appreciate what Woj and Shams do and everything, and Mark Stein. Like, those guys are really great at what they do. I definitely wouldn't want to do that. That's interesting to me to hear, though, that that's what a lot of people want to break into.
Yeah, I'm on your side, by the way, but I was just that was one of the more interesting things that I heard, like, on the outer fringe of the NBA, you know, with the side that, like, is never talked about, like, the media side of things.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to be Stephen A. Smith. I don't really get why anyone wouldn't want to be Stephen A. Smith.
I want to be Stephen A. Smith.
Michael Jordan wouldn't even be able to play in today's NBA. ESPN.
Jordan wouldn't hit on soft 17 with an A-shirt. That was a bad impression. I'll stop.
Michael Jordan would always hit.
Yeah, no, everything. Yeah.
Should we dive back into the Magic, though?
Yeah, let's do it. I mean, as far as I can tell, there's only really 2 guys that were really worth mentioning that were at summer league for the Magic. Both bigs, Jonathan Isaacs and, of course, Mo Bamba.
Yep.
You know, as far as the Magic, I've watched him play a few times. Unfortunately, I missed the game that everyone was kind of talking about, where Isaac and Bamba kind of put Jared Jackson Jr. in the Welcome to the NBA Rook, you know, summer league showcase.
Luckily,
but it's interesting.
I saw that entire game. It's the one game I caught in its entirety.
Oh, really?
For the Magic, yeah.
Yeah, I was, I forget what I was watching, but, you know, the dude I was watching with, he pulled up Twitter after, it was like, oh my gosh, you know, like, Mo Bamba and John Isaac just murdering JJJ, and then, you know, we thought about going over, but, you know, it's interesting, it's like, as much like you try to watch as much basketball as possible, you're not coming out to Summer League to watch the basketball. You're going out there to have the conversations, you know? So like, if you're not networking during games, even when you're sitting down, you're doing it wrong, in my opinion.
Right. That makes sense, of course. If you're trying to work in the league and everything, or work tangentially to the league, you know, if you're just there as a fan, it's different, I guess, but...
Truly. And, like, let me tell you, you know, as a fan, like, the first couple days are fun, but, like, I would not want to go more than 1 or 2 days if I was just out there to watch some basketball. But going back to Bamba and Jonathan Isaacs, I think the first guy was probably Bamba, right?
Yeah, let's talk about Bamba, definitely.
You know, my big takeaway with Bamba, I mean, it's interesting because, like, Kevin Knox was the guy, in my opinion, who kind of got the buzz as being the workout warrior, you know, the guy who, like, NBA teams were, like, you know, falling for, you know, more than they probably should have based on his workout and his interviewing skills. The entire time that was unfolding, and I think you're of like mind with this as a supporter, it felt to me like Bamba was actually like the classic case of the guy that you just make excuse after excuse for, you know? And like, obviously, like, you know, he's just like Aiden. It's not hard to see the vision, you know, when somebody's a giant dude who can block shots and like might be able to shoot threes at some point. Like, yeah, it doesn't take a genius to realize like that guy, if it all comes through, is going to be insanely valuable. But, you know, I think you're the first person in my little network to mention this. Like, watching him at Texas, like, there were times where he was just kind of bad.
Oh, definitely.
And, you know, like, watching him in summer, like, the first thing that stands out when you're watching him is that on offense, he's just stiff. And, like, you know, like, stiff, when I mean stiff, I mean more tight in his, like, movements. I don't, it's like, you know, like when you call a big man a stiff, you're basically saying, like, you know, that he's just a big body and there's no place for him in the league. That's not him, at least not at this point. But, like, as far as, like, you know, like, for the buzz that he gets for, you know, like, oh, he's going to have a three-point shot, like, watching him take those fall-away jumpers, and, yeah, he's giant, and, like, you know, you have to grade him on a curve. But, like, at no point in offense does he look like a fluid athlete, you know?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. His fluidity is definitely something that is lacking. But what he does have is he's, you know, he's showed, in what I saw in Summer League, he was able to catch alley-oops, run, and if he can just shoot as, like, a trailing big guy, then... offensively, I think he has just enough to get by, if that makes sense. But I do agree. I mean, when I would watch him at Texas, sometimes I would just ask myself, like, is he good at basketball, like, at all? Like, that was the question I often found myself pondering.
Yeah, like, you know, he's able to block shots, and, like, you know, like, he's structurally, like, Drew Hanlon's done a great job. Like, structurally, his shot looks fine, especially, like, from, like, the feet up. One of the things that I noticed, and this is something that I've never seen anyone else mention on Twitter or in, like, you know, the basketball, like, social media verse. Watching him warm up, something that jumped out to me is that, so, like, you know, if he's shooting on a clock and he's shooting at 12 o'clock every single time, he jumps towards about 9:30 to 10, like, noticeably so. He jumps about, like, 6 or so inches to his left on every single shot, especially from the outside. And I'm kind of, you know, as far as shooting goes, you know, like, I learned from some people who are great shooters on how to shoot the basketball. My big thing is repeatable motion, touch and repeatable motion, you know, getting the ball up on your fingertips, snapping the wrist, the classic stuff. But one of the things that was relayed to me from a guy who was a 20-year overseas pro is that, like, a lot of times great shooters will land in their own feet, you know, and, like, you know, if you're not landing in your own feet, you better be jumping forward. Jumping to the left is very – jumping in any direction that's not forward is very concerning to me.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's just it adds one more component of motion that you have to, like, account for in your jumper.
I'm a big guy when it comes to basketball. But, I mean, like, not only does it add motion, it adds motion that is counter – I don't know what the word is, you know, the scientific term. But it's like a crosswind, you know? It's not leading you towards – you know, your intended target. You have to fight against that motion to get back towards the path that you want to shoot the ball at, you know?
Right. So does the sideways jumping of Bamba and his jumper really make you seriously doubt his potential to ever become a consistent NBA three-point shooter?
Yeah, unless he fixes it, yes. You know, like, he can shoot, like, to me, the break-even point for, like, a stretch five is, like, 34-35%. It's obviously probably the lowest break point for, like, you know, if you're above this watermark, you know, shoot it. If you're below it, don't shoot it. I think it's going to be hard for him to get to 35% unless he really works on eliminating that part of his mechanics. I don't think I've ever seen, you know, like one of the trends with Curry was, you know, twist shooting, or twisting you know, your body on its like revolving it with your shot. I've never seen a guy who's jumping away from the hoop. That's just bizarre to me.
Right, right.
And who knows? Maybe this is all just part of a plan, or maybe he was just screwing around. But like, I noticed him doing that, and he did it about 5 or 6 times in a row, and I was like, is this just kind of a shot? But yeah, and like, you know, that is as far as like assessing the value that he brings on offense. Like, when you think about why he was drafted as high as he was, a big part of it was the whole idea, like, yeah, this guy can possibly be a guy who can knock down threes. If you take away that component of it, he's just like a worse, more stiff Rudy Gobert.
Yeah, exactly. And,
like, Rudy Gobert is obviously very good. Are we gonna assume that Mo Bamba is gonna be a guy who can be effective on offense if he can't shoot at all, though?
I mean, I'm not at that point where I feel comfortable saying that. Like, the three-pointer is clearly one of the necessary components for him as a player, as a prospect for me.
Yeah, it really felt like the linchpin of what made him go as high as he did, you know? Like, if he's a guy who's just blocking shots, he's probably going, like, what, 8, 9, 10? Because, like, you know, as far as, like, catching lobs and, like, dump downs, it wasn't like he was blowing anybody away at Texas. I mean, obviously he had that fantastic three-court sprint, and we actually did see that a few times, which I don't think we did see at all at Texas, with him really sprinting the floor and looking, you know, being aggressive and pursuing his running lanes. But it really feels like, for like as much as like we can get excited about Bamba, with like Mitchell Robinson playing probably better, looking more fluid, and I believe even being a little bit younger, I don't know. It's just it feels like Bamba's kind of the guy where like there's not smoke yet, but like there's something potentially here with the summer league performance not being as dominant as we would hope from a guy with his physical gifts and going as high as he did.
Concerning. What about Jonathan Isaac?
Take away that one game against Jared Jackson Jr. and then what are his averages? I think he averaged like 9, 8, and 3.
Yeah.
You know, if he crushed Jaren Jackson Jr., he's probably looking at like 7, 8, and 2.5 or something like that, taking away, you know, factoring out those that game.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he was really good in that game. But even better, the guy who really stood out in that game, and I want to hear your thoughts on, is Jonathan Isaac. I mean, Jonathan Isaac gave Jaren Jackson Jr. fits.
Jonathan Isaac almost looks like an early to mid 2000s, like, small forward, if you, like, times him by, like, point, you know, like 1.1 and like all of his like his measurables. It's pretty nuts, like, seeing how fluid he is. He's kind of an enigma to me, because like he weirdly seems like he just kind of loves that 18-foot 2-dribble pull up, and I'm like, that's not, first of all, that's not where the league's going. Second of all, that's not your game. You know, like, you don't need to prove anything to anybody, man. Just take threes and get to the rim. Like, an 18-footer. Maybe you'll have some old heads, you know, at the park talking about how, you know, how the mid-range is coming back. Like, that doesn't help your team win basketball games.
Right.
Is this just me? Am I seeing what I want to see kind of with that? Or
no, I mean, he definitely has a propensity, at least what I saw in summer league, to take those kind of pull-up mid-rangers. My hope was just that that's a guy who was forced into a big creation role on a team, and he's not really ready for that yet. And it's probably going to carry over to the season, because he's going to have a lot of creation responsibility for the Magic this year as well. And that's just him not being able to create great shots yet. But, you know, he's young still. That's not something I'm going to freak out yet. You know, what I saw from him on the defensive end and the certain flashes on offense were really encouraging for me personally. But I agree that he does like his mid-range twos.
Yeah, I mean, his flashes are as bright as about anybody, you know, any young player in the league from his draft class, you know, onward. I know that's only a year and a half now, your two draft classes, but, you know, like, it's easy to see the vision with him. You know, like, he's a guy who could potentially be, like, you know, the tallest small ball five in the league, and also, you know, like, taking you off the dribble a little bit. But I have to believe that, like, his ideal optimal usage rate is somewhere between 18% and 21%, you know. If he's pushing 23%, 24%, 25%, you know, you're just going to see, I think, turnovers fly through the roof on him. You're going to see, you know, true shooting percent drop, you know, to well below league average levels. I mean, part of the reason that it's hard to be optimistic about the Magic is, like, it feels like they have no plan. It feels like their plan is get length and athleticism, and it'll all work out. And, I mean, like, you know, when you hit Giannis, it works out. Most of the time, that doesn't work out. You need skill position players. And, like, it, yeah, I don't – I
I want to argue.
They have to be terrible again this year, yeah.
I mean, I think they're going to be horrible this year, unquestionably.
Oh, they're going to be borderline unwatchable for stretches, I feel like.
Yeah, but I want to argue that their idea and their vision is they're getting this length for defensive purposes. So they're going to have these guys, Gordon, Isaac, and Bamba, who are the 3, 4, and 5, provide like unbelievable length and athleticism so they can really build a stifling defense. And I think the idea has to be to get your 1 and 2 in the next 2 drafts who are really good offensive creators, who are just knockdown shooters, you know, who really open up the offense.
Wouldn't you need those guys to also be high usage players with the current pieces as they're assembled? Because Bamba never just figures to be a high usage guy.
Yep.
Jonathan Isaacs, I don't believe, will ever be, you know, a guy that you want above 20% usage. And Aaron Gordon, I'm not sure, you know, like, what's the plan with them? Like, you just paid him, but, you know, you also have, you know, these guys who are basically not 100% clones of him. They're not as athletic, but, like, as far as, like, the pluses that he brings to the table, there's a lot of redundancy with Aaron Gordon all of a sudden on the roster. It feels like the guys that they'd be chasing in future drafts are, like, I hate to say, like, Curry and Clay, but, like, it's hard for me to, like, I imagine Dennis Smith Jr. or De'Aaron Fox being successful, in those type of players being successful with the system they've built right now. And that's even, you know, assuming that potentially Mo Bamba can be a guy who can stretch the floor at the 5.
Yeah. I mean, they definitely need a guy. I mean, you're not going to get a Curry, but they needed, like, a Curry archetype player at the 1, I feel like, to really unlock this team's potential.
One of your best takes of the past couple of years has been this idea that, like, a unicorn, as far as a big man, is going to become more and more prevalent, and I agree with that take, and I think it's something that's not talked about very often, but there is a definite trend in that direction. But it almost feels like they're a little bit late to the party, and they didn't even get, like, the best unicorns, and now they have to go find the guys that are actually becoming more scarce, you know? And maybe I'm just forecasting a little bit too static of an outlook for the Magic, but it has the makings of a puzzle that just, like, doesn't fit together already.
Terrifying. Yeah, I will say it's starting to almost remind me of, like, the Magic's teams in 2015 or so, where you're like, I really like a lot of the pieces they have. I like these young guys, and that's proven mostly correct. A lot of those young guys end up being good NBA players, but they just didn't coherently fit together, and I worry the downside of this Magic team is that's where they're headed.
I mean, you know, they have to be looking, you know, and I'm not sure if you guys have even talked about the 2019 draft yet, but the Magic, they have to be just thinking, like, it's Zion, RJ Barrett, or bust for us, you know? I don't think there's a guy out there, and, like, you know, people come out of nowhere every single season, but it just doesn't feel like there's a guy out there in this draft class that makes sense with a high pick for the Magic. Like, they could be looking at dumping, or not dumping, but dealing Jonathan Isaac or maybe even Mo Bamba next year's draft. Like, that's insanity.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think RJ Barrett's a great fit either. You know, that's kind of one of the concerns.
I don't think so either, but, like, you know, if you're gonna take the shot, he's the guy to shoot it with, right?
Yeah.
Because Zion makes no sense on that team. You know, like,
more like a Cameron Reddish. Cameron Reddish could make sense, or maybe, you know, Nasir Little almost makes more sense than Barrett. You know, these smaller little guys who are more 2s than 3s.
Yeah, exactly. I guess Zion does make a little bit more sense when you think about it through the lens of if Mo Bamba.
But
it's,
I think,
crazy
Zion's
how much
a
we
4.
Keep coming back to Mo Bamba's 3-point shooting. Exactly. Like, then it would have to be that big lineup where Zion's playing the 3-4, Isaac's playing the 3-4-5, and Bamba's just a static 5. I feel like that could work with the right pieces around them if all those guys are able to reach their potential and Zion's able to embrace that role and also shoot a little bit, you know?
But the highest paid guy on their team is Aaron Gordon.
It's crazy how much of this seems to hinge on if Mo Bamba can shoot threes.
Oh,
which
it
is
all
very
hinges
concerning.
On Bamba shooting threes.
I don't like that.
All right, yeah. Should we dive into the Hawks? I know you have lots of Trae Young thoughts.
I have a lot of Trae Young thoughts. I almost feel like we should get, like, my ancillary Hawks thoughts out of the way first, because, like, you know, based on how he played, I mean, like, Spellman seems like he's just going to be, like, a guy at best, you know? Like, there were very few flashes from him at Summer League that made me think, like, yeah, there goes the first round pick.
Do you know who
that's
he reminds
fine.
Me of?
Who?
On offense, he reminds me so much of Maurice Spates.
I was going to say that, too!
Oh.
Like, I 100% agree. It's And, like, he doesn't seem to move all that well. Like, he seems skilled and, like, he seems like he knows what he's doing. But, like, you know, watching him play in Summer League, it was kind of like, this guy's kind of plodding around a lot, it feels like, you know?
Oh, definitely, definitely. I wasn't high on him. I was sad Kevin Huerter, you know, hurt his hand and we didn't get to see him at all in Summer League, because I think he would have been an interesting fit to see in Summer League. But what can you do?
I mean, like, the one good thing is that John Collins played one game and he looked sensational playing line. Young really struggled that game, but Collins looked fantastic. I don't know if he got hurt. I think got rolled up on at one point that game, and then maybe were like, oh, this is just not worth it. But he looked just very, very good. He looks like a guy who's just going to be like a very complimentary fit with Trae Young. But you know, it the whole discussion with the Hawks, and we could talk for an hour about Trae Young's Summer League's up and downs, but you and I, we chatted about this briefly, I think, a couple days before he had this nice little two-game spurt at the end where he was hitting his shots. You and I think, both agreed that, like, there was a lot to like about his performances, even up in Salt Lake.
Yes, completely agreed. I really liked as we talked about in the pod yesterday with me and Daniel, I liked that he was getting to the line, and I think he's showing that he can really create for others were the two most encouraging things. And then the other thing is just he wasn't as bad on defense as I thought he might be. And I know you were always higher on his defense in college than most people were, but I think the fact that he didn't have a ton of struggles in Summer League was an encouraging sign for me.
I mean, I've learned over the years not to go for big air, you know, with takes, and like go so hard against the consensus that you're really putting yourself out there, and just kind of, you know, understate if you believe something that's kind of like, you know, a 2%, 3% of the population held stance. I think Trae Young's going to be good on defense. I really do. I'm not sure if it'll happen his rookie year, but like a lot of course hinges on if he's going to be able to conserve his energy and how much he's going to be able to do that on offense. But like, there's a lot to like with him. He understands the game. I mean, like, for how much people talk about NBA pedigrees, and I love talking about the guys whose dads played in the NBA or moms played in the WNBA, or even just were athletes in general, but especially basketball players. Trae Young's dad, Ray Young, was a very, very good player at Texas Tech back in the early 2000s. He didn't play in the league, but he was a very similar archetype to Trae, where he took a lot of three-pointers, got to the rim very well. But, like, if you're going to succeed in the Steph Curry archetype, it feels like you need to have a father or a mother who can explain to you, you know, from a young age, this is how you can do this and get your shots at a high level. And I feel like his separation that he got at Summer League, even when his shots weren't dropping, it was like, this guy is open a lot off the dribble.
And yes, definitely agree.
I walked away very encouraged. Like, you know, the way I view it is like, either there's two things that Trae Young's entire career is going to hinge on. Can he get separation and can he hit shots? The separation stuff, we saw a lot of positive indicators this Summer League, I felt like, to make me believe that he will be able to get consistent separation. And, like, do you really want to be the guy that, like, thinks that Trae Young won't be making shots if he's open? You know? Like, that doesn't seem like a very good stance. Like, he didn't have a very high percentage at Oklahoma, but he was taking some crazy shots, and like his stand still catch and shoot situations. I mean, his PPP was 1.4 in those situations, even on like only about 50 possessions. That's high enough where you got to believe there's something to it.
Yeah, I mean, I believe in Trae Young's shot, but I will admit that my confidence has wavered just a little, because now we've had like such a long string of him seeming to struggle. He struggled almost the entire second half of the college season. And then he's, you know, struggled most of Summer League until these last two games. So I worry a little that he's just such a streaky shooter that there's like, it's not going to be, it's just going to be some games he goes 0-7 and some games he goes 7-7, but it's going to be like two or three games of him going like 1-20 combined. And then we have one where he's like 6-7 or whatever. And then his stats end up looking fine, but it's not consistent enough to be.
The aggregate is fine, the median is terrible, and the quartiles are not helping you.
Exactly.
I could totally see that. I don't think it's going to happen. Like, you know, with shooters, like, the number one thing is, like, is he Robert Covington or is he J.J. Redick? You know, like, that is a very important part to, like, trying to put together a winning team. How consistent are these guys going to be able to make shots? To your point about him struggling in Oklahoma, I really think that – I think that the way that we talked about Markelle Fultz's cast at Washington – that is the way we should talk about Trae Young's cast at Oklahoma. My general theory is that, like, any basketball player to play in Division I basketball is, of course, skilled and has ability. That Oklahoma team, though, those guys, just watch them play, they seemed so low on basketball intelligence, basketball understanding of concepts. They struck me as like, you know, like if you were to make the argument against AAU basketball, just pop in any, you know, Big 12 game that Oklahoma played last year. I mean, some of those guys alongside Trae Young had no idea what to do unless the ball was in their hands and they're going to the hoop.
Yeah, they were horrible. That was always my takeaway watching them play, is that those teammates were so bad. One of the reasons
I don't think there's a single guy at this point who I would project to be in a top league in Europe at any point in his career. And that's saying something considering they're playing high major basketball.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things that, like, people don't talk about enough in making the transition, in my opinion, from college to the NBA, shooting the college basketball is an absolute dream. Those Wilson balls, they stick to your fingers just the right amount. You snap the wrist, you get good, consistent rotation every single time. They're fantastic. The NBA basketball is a turd. For some reason, the NBA likes their balls overinflated and slick. And I think if you have smaller hands, it takes you a while to adjust to those balls. And that's why you see so many air balls in summer league, is because, like, if you don't snap very, very well and you don't have your finger distribution on the ball just so the balance is fantastic, that ball is going to kind of wibble and wobble on you. It's going to sail. It's going to come up short. I have to think that, like, some of Trae Young's issues in summer leagues had to be the basketball. The number one, like, you know, when my guys are trying to get in the gym and trying to make that jump from college to the NBA, the number one thing that they have to have, and they even know it, and they will seek it out, is they have to have NBA basketballs. They will make connections with sketchy people just to get at NBA basketballs. It's that important.
That's interesting. That's a nice little piece of insight that I definitely think most fans don't consider when thinking about the transition, how different the balls are.
How would you know? Unless you've ever felt one, you know, like, I can say all these things about it. Like, until you feel one, you're not going to understand that, like, the ball is weird. It's like a throwback to the 1950s. It is a strange way for, you know, like, to go from the high school to the college to even the FIBA ball to this thing. It's weird. There's an adjustment period for that alone, I think.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It would explain why guys who are good shooters struggle in their first year normally in the NBA to adjust.
I'd be interesting to see a correlation between a three-point percentage in college versus three-point percentage in the NBA as a ratio along the y-axis, and the x-axis would be hand size. I'd be very interested to see if there's any connection between those two. And I think it would probably dissipate after the third or fourth year, but those first 2 years, it seems like the guys with the smaller hands can really struggle with shooting the basketball.
That is interesting. It makes sense, like, intuitively. I'd love to see data on that as well.
If only there was an analytics guy who could put together something like that.
Yeah, if only I knew someone who worked in NBA analytics who worked on that exact type of stuff.
I'll see if I can cook something up. Maybe I'll have a graph to put on you guys' Twitter.
Oh, perfect. You want to dive in on the Nets a little? I know I'd like to hear your thoughts on, you know, Jared Allen, but I know you got a guy there who you're really excited about.
I do. Jared Allen was one of the most interesting players in summer league to me this year. Quick shout out, the most baffling person, and anybody who's on my Twitter would know where I'm going with this, the most baffling person I saw in summer league was Henry Ellison of the Pistons. For some reason, Henry Ellison got drafted as a potential stretch four / offensive rebounder, and now he wants to be like Royce White. It makes no sense. The guy's addicted to putting the ball in between his legs off the dribble. It is the weirdest thing I've ever seen. But anyway, so Jared Allen was interesting because I think he only played in three or four games. He was there the entire time, though. And, like, you know, Jared Allen might be the most distinct-looking guy in the NBA, being that tall with that fro. It's like you're always just kind of, like, passively aware of what he's doing, even if you're not watching him and holding in on him. So, like, you're always going to come away with an opinion on Jared Allen if you're watching him play. In those games, normally he would be a guy that would, like, kind of, like, mix into the crowd of just, like, the general summer league player pool based on how he was playing the game. It was almost like he was cosplaying as a role player. You know, instead of coming out there and being like, I'm the best guy on this team, which he clearly was, he was like, this is not going to help me unless I am going through the motions that I would go through as a role player on this Nets team. On one hand, I think that's a smart approach. On the other hand, strange, you know? Like, you would want to see your first-round pick being like, throw me the ball, I'm getting... You know, like Miles Bridges was very up and down this summer league, but that's a guy who was like, hey, I'm the number one guy on this team. Give me the ball. I'm going to get us a look. And quite frankly, you know, if you don't think it's a good look, well, you try and make a better one. I bet you can't. Jared Allen didn't do that. Jared was, like, just kind of taking what the defense was giving. He was hitting the boards. He was setting picks. He was catching around the rim. Like, every game he had, like, one or two, like, really sensational plays. But for the most part, he's kind of blended in. And I thought that was very strange.
Yeah, that is strange. You know, it's yeah, I mean, it's good that a guy wants to play his role, but it's also nice when your young guys, when they have an opportunity to really expand their game and push themselves, when they take that chance and really run with it.
Yeah, and I mean, like, obviously, like, you know, I'm self-aware enough to realize I just hammered, you know, a 23-year-old dude for trying to do too much at Summer League, and then I'm turning around and I'm trying to point out that, like, you know, a 20-year-old I thought should have been doing more. So I think there's a balance. You know, like, you should be working on aspects of your game that's not quite NBA refs, game refs, ready yet, but you should be playing within yourself. I don't know. It was just like I feel like the his decision, whether it was, you know, via the front office, the coaching staff, or his own prerogative to do this, I think it's going to make more sense when we look back on this through the lens of like 2 or 3 years later. But for right now, I can't make heads or tails of it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Do you want to dive into your favorite guy from all of Summer League, it seemed like, on Twitter?
Yes, I do. I'm probably going to butcher his name. Yuta Watanabe, I think it is.
That's what I have. Yeah, Yuta Watanabe is how I've kind of heard it pronounced as well.
You know, it's normally, like, if a guy breaks out in Summer League, you know his name because the announcer's saying it so much. He was very interesting. I had multiple conversations with analytics people in front offices and independently about just him. He is a poster boy for, you know, production does not equal impact, and that works both ways, but especially for the guys who, when you look, like, if you were to go look at his game logs right now, and you'd be like, oh my god, this guy's talking him up, like, how'd I miss him? There's nothing in those game logs that would make you say, like, oh, this guy's a can't-miss dude. I think the most points he scored in a game in Summer League was like 13. But the way that he played the game, especially on offense, I hate to call anybody, like, basketball, you know, like, IQ or concepts-wise brilliant, but, like, he just didn't make any mistakes. It was crazy. He was like a spacing doctor. Every single time that he moved or did not move, it was the right decision. And his teammates, for some reason, especially once Jared Allen was out, refused to hit him. He was wide open a lot, and it was like they froze him out for no reason. The game that really stood out to me, and like I originally noticed him in the Nets Timberwolves game, and I was kind of like, this guy's doing a lot of really little things. It seems like every time he's in the game, the Nets go on a run. Every time he goes out, the Nets kind of give us some points. And then I watched another game. I see who they're playing. He played once again solid. You know, like I started tweeting about him at that point because I was like, this guy's interesting. The third game, I believe they're playing the Pacers, and in 17 minutes with him on the floor, they were minus 8. And at 23, he wasn't on the floor, they were minus 30. And he had, like, 8 points on 7 shots and like, 2 assists. But, like, that is, as far as, like, you know, like, if you're looking for a guy in Summer League, do you really want the guy who's just beating up on inferior competition like Dwayne Bacon, who's just going around people, you know, like, guys who will never play in the NBA, guys who cannot defend an NBA level, you know, and like just going for the volume shooter? Or do you want the guy who can easily fill in a plug-and-play role and may actually surprise you down the road, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Give his background, what makes him like an especially interesting prospect?
Oh, yes, yeah. He was born and raised in Japan in the first 14 years of his life. Both of his parents were professional basketball players. He came over to America for prep school and then played 4 years at George Washington. And the thing is, he's a stretch four, but his career field goal percentage from three in college was 33.4, I believe. And at no point did he ever shoot 37% or better. So he's a stretch four who doesn't really shoot it all that well, but still is helping the team. It's a very interesting, like, he's a truly unique player, it seems like. I mean, like, as much as I hate to talk about, you know, like the international dynamics and economics of basketball, quite frankly, it makes sense to sign a two-way deal just to see if you can capture the Japanese demographic. You'd be the second ever national citizen to the second ever Japanese citizen to ever play in the NBA. There was a Yuta Wabuse, I think his name was. He played point guard for the Suns for about 4 games about 10 years ago. But as far as like hype on a nationwide level, Yuta Watanabe is like the guy. They call him the chosen one in Japan.
Yeah, I mean, we talk a lot on this podcast about how Jeremy Lin is a real driver of interest in Asia, but it sounds like another perfect example.
Ko Z is a real, or Ko Chi. I don't even need to know his name. He's terrible, but like we Zhou know
Chi.
His name because Zhou Chi. He's never going to be relevant in any NBA way except for selling jerseys and capturing a marketplace. I mean, that guy, it's like his pregame rituals dipping the lower half of his body in concrete. It is unbelievable to watch him in person. But, like, this guy, Yuta Watanabe, like, not only is he going to potentially be able to help you in the international market, he might be a good effing player.
Sounds like definitely a guy worth at least taking a chance on with a two-way.
I mean, oh, at an absolute minimum. I mean, like, you know, if I was one of these teams and I was a front office guy, I'm like, if I can get this guy in the minimum for 2 years, like, that is the ultimate home run, especially if I can get it, like, partially guaranteed or non-guaranteed for the second year. Like, I normally approach things from a player perspective, like, trying to help the players make, you know, the best financial decisions for them. But, like, if I'm a front office guy and, like, this guy falls in my lap, I'm jumping for joy. Like, he is the ultimate can't-lose situation.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Also, I have to say real fast, the Nets summer league team was terrible. They were.
Was Jared it truly Allen was horrible?
Great. Excuse me. He was good doing what he was doing. Everybody else, I wanted, these games, like, it's kind of like a high school game in the sense, like, you're right in the floor, like, you know, like, the people who are all there have vested interest in the people on the floor. There's no real fans. I wanted to shout at these guys, you're not helping your cause. It's this thing where, like, the incentive structure in the NBA and Summer League for guys who do not have deals is to try and score. That starts snowballing, and it becomes the prisoner's dilemma of, like, shot selection. It gets bad fast. And then if you also add in the equation not a lot of talent or skill, oh my gosh. It was really...
Joe?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're cutting out a little, but you're through now.
Should we keep going? Or do you think we should pause it? Just make sure.
We can keep going. I think you're coming through clear now. You want to move on and just... I know you didn't watch much of the Kings.
We have to pause it to make sure like that I didn't cut out completely at the end there.
No, you did. I mean, I can hear you. It's fine. You're good. It's not a big deal.
Okay, so you want to cut this part then?
No, we'll leave it. This is how we do the podcast. Everyone gets to see a little.
Oh, I hate that you guys do this. Oh, it's the worst. All right, your show.
Exactly, my show. I know you didn't see the Kings play much, but did you hear any buzz around Summer League about any of the Kings players at all? Anything interesting in that sense, since you didn't see them play much?
You know, the most interesting conversation I had about the Kings, I had with a gentleman who's developing a patent to help stabilize, muscle structure and ligament structure in knees. That guy was very interesting. The Kings were not interesting at all to me. I'm sorry.
Like, I assume he was working with Giles?
I'm not sure who he's working with. He gave me the X's and O's of the machine, and I walked in like, that's a cool guy. You know, like, it was one of those things, like, I wanted to see Marvin Bagley at one point, and then, like, I felt like I got the full Marvin Bagley experience just by following the Salt Lake City Summer League, you know? Like,
yep.
As far as, like, the distribution of outcomes, like, I feel like I got, like, the upper end and the lower end. I don't need to see the stuff in the middle, you know?
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, and, like, I guess I probably should have made more of an effort because, like, Harry Giles, I guess, looked, like, very solid and healthy, and that's great. Like, you always want to root for that. But, like, as far as, like, the interest level of the Kings, I mean, like, who am I going to get excited about Marvin Bagley, like, at his best this season, being a guy who scores 20 points and gives up 35? Like, I'm not – I actually kind of like Marvin Bagley more than most people as a long-term prospect. But, like, as far as, like, hype, why, you know?
Yeah.
Like, is there anything that they have cooking there that's must-see TV? You know, it was – like, I actually – one of my high school teammates and buddies played for the Detroit Pistons team. He didn't get a whole lot of playing time. I went to go watch him potentially get in garbage time and watch that entire game instead of watching the Kings play. And I forget who they were playing, but it was kind of a marquee matchup. I chose watching that instead because I had no interest in watching the Kings.
Fair.
There's just nothing for anybody there. Like, you guys are masochists for even, like, talking about, like, you know, like, potential long-term thinking with them. It's just, like, they have so little going for them as far as, like, tangible, concrete assets. It's hard to care. It is for me. I'm sorry.
No worries.
there was, and I hate to take shots at people who work for organizations, so I won't. It was one of those things. Whenever I saw a guy wearing a Kings like polo in summer league, I'm like, I bet you're really talented, and I bet you get ignored a lot. That was always my, like, that whenever I saw a guy wearing a jersey, I'm like, I bet you did a lot of great work for 6 years, and now you don't get listened to.
Yeah.
I their process just is just, it's an open secret even among fans. Their process is, like, notoriously awful.
Fair. Well, since it's my podcast and I can ask you whatever I want, I'd love to hear your thoughts on the Pacers Summer League.
I think TJ Leaf set the record for least jumps per 36 for Summer League.
Well, you know what? You got to save those legs, man. You know, you only have a certain number of jumps in your knees.
Exactly. I know better than anybody. It was one of those things where, like, TJ Leaf, for some reason, is just so easily hateable that, like, even when he does something, like, no one in the crowd would ever give him credit. But he actually did a few nice games, but it was just, like, it's hard. Unless he's going to be, like, a Kevin Love-style player, and it's really doubtful that he's going to get there, it's hard to see him ever being a starter-level player in this league. And, like, you know, he could come on, like, I will say this, he thinks the game very well. You can understand, like, he understands basketball. Like, it's very evident just watching his, like, how he sets up his moves. He's very good with ball fakes. He understands, like, angles. But as far as, like, his ability to get to his spots or even just, like, make his shots, there's just not a whole lot there, it feels like.
That's fair. What about Aaron Holiday?
Oh, I loved him. I thought he kind of struggled a little bit more as the week went on. But, like, as far as, like, the blueprint of, like, a guy that you would want to get with that pick, you know, he made some threes off the dribble. He made good decisions. Both as far as playing the NBA, like, Aaron Holiday is not surprised by anything he sees on the floor. Like, he has a plan for everything as far as, like, with the ball in his hands or on defense. He struck me as the most mature player I saw at Summer League in this rookie class.
That's encouraging.
But, yeah, and, like, you know, I think Trae Young would also be up there, but, like, there was just a general air of just, like, Aaron Holiday being like, yep, seen this. Yep, been there. Like, this is the read. This is the play. Like, at no point did he ever seem to second-guess himself. And that's what you want to see out of guys who are, like, not freshmen in Summer League.
Yep, definitely.
Are we missing a team? I think we only talked about four there.
Nope, we got them all. The Suns, the Magic, the Nets, the Kings, and the Hawks. We got them all.
Oh, yeah, I guess I immediately blacked out that we talked about the Kings because I didn't want to talk about them.
Yeah, exactly. any stories from Summer League that were good? Any, you know, other players you want to talk about?
You know, I've got a few. The number one fun story that I have, I was sitting and watching a game just kind of by myself waiting to meet up with some people. And there was a guy in front of me who seemed just very colorful and just very full of life. We started chatting, and then he gets up to walk away. He says, "Oh, by the way, I'm an agent." And I'm like, "Oh, are you like a FIBA guy?" He's like, "Oh no, I rep Thabo Sefolosha and Max, what's his name from Dallas." And I was like, "Oh, you are an agent. Like, you're not just here trying to, like, you know, like, pull the wool over someone's eyes. Like, you are a legitimate agent." And we swapped information. This guy's name, his name's Guy Zucker. I wish he had a Twitter page, because it would be just, like, the most absolute must-follow guy. I tell him about analytics, and, like, we go back and forth emailing. The first thing he asks me when he gets my phone number is if I've ever read Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. We don't even talk about basketball. We jump right into Hunter S. Thompson, and I'm like, "No, I haven't." He's like, "Oh, you have to read it." It's like, you know, like, he starts breaking down, like, the themes of the book. I'm like, "Didn't you want to talk about basketball?" Like, he's like, "Nah, this is more fun." And I gotta say, all around nice guy. Like, he's connected me with some people around the league that I'm very happy he's connected me with. And, like, I told him, like, "Dude, anything that you need from me analytically, let me know. I owe you, like, a million just for, like, becoming, like, in your circle." So yeah, Guy Zucker, all around just fun guy. Like, if you ever are sitting in a basketball game, there's an Israeli man talking about Hunter S. Thompson or Fyodor Dostoevsky in front of you. Ask what his name is. If it's Guy, you're gonna have a great night. Another really fun takeaway. There's this guy who I'm not sure what his standing is among American basketball enthusiasts. He's a journalist. His name is Mark Deeks. Are you familiar with him by chance?
Who is it?
Mark Deeks.
No, I'm not familiar.
So this guy, he basically runs content for the NBA in the United Kingdom. He's English. This guy knows, I want to say, conservative estimate, he probably knows off the top of his head everything about 1,000 professional basketball players right now in the world.
Wow.
It is, yeah, he wrote what I've been calling a manifesto. I forget what he calls it, but he might actually call it a manifesto too. He wrote 4,000 words about every single team. Excuse me, not 4,000. 400,000. He wrote 400,000 words on all 30 teams in the NBA, all their players, their outlook with their cap situation, their future picks owed, just literally everything you could possibly need to know about the NBA. And he published it and gave it away for free. And, like, just having conversations with this guy, it blew me away. He is becoming – and, like, I tell him, like, dude, if basketball ever takes off in the United Kingdom, you're going to be the guy. Like, I hate to call him the Zach Lowe of the United Kingdom, but, like, I was just very impressed with his just knowledge of absolutely everything. He's a guy who I think is going to work in the front office someday. If you don't follow him on Twitter, he's a great follow. Mark Deeks, great guy. Very good basketball mind. Like, that is a guy who I'm not sure, like, what his profile is in America, but that is a must-follow, in my opinion.
Interesting. Good to know.
Yeah.
Well.
I mean, as far as stories, that's about it. You know, it is fun, you know, like, sitting in summer league and, like, realizing that, like, there's the parents of a player in front of you. That's an all-time great one. But, like, as far as, like, you know, dedicated stories, I don't really have that many that are repeatable this time.
Did you split any tens at the blackjack table?
Come on, mama didn't raise no fool.
Fair enough. All right, well, thanks for coming on, Joe. Thanks for going out to Vegas and being our summer league correspondent, you know. I'm glad you liked our accommodation so much.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate you guys putting them in Hooters Hotel and Casino. That was really nice of you guys.
Oh, you know, we're very thoughtful. You know, I mean, we make so much ad revenue on this podcast, we had to splurge on you.
Yeah, hey, thanks for having me on, by the way, man. This Sasquatch Metrics reunion was fun.
Oh, yeah, this was a great time. All right, talk to you later, buddy.
All right, talk to you later.
Peace.